The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is the seventh and final day of this seven-day Sesshin in November 2014. And we will be beginning, this is Wednesday, we will be beginning the Rohatsu Sesshin on Monday. This is one chance to do two in a row in quick succession of Sesshin and a tremendous opportunity to take a person's practice much deeper. There are three in a row, or there have been three in a row until this past year, apparently, this year, I should say, at Sogenji, each with just a few days in between. And it is amazing how much deeper one can get doing that kind of training. Three sesshin in a row, boom, boom, boom. There isn't a chance to really come up for much air in between each one, with the result that we start out the next sesshin already deeper than we would have if we'd been waiting for another month for a sesshin. And then the same is true of the third sesshin succeeding. Here we try to do two similarly. In the West, of course, Thanksgiving comes the end of November, so that makes it a little bit challenging. And tomorrow is Thanksgiving Day. Most people want to spend Thanksgiving Day with their families or friends, and so they don't really want to be in sesshin at that time, which means we limit our sesshin to before Thanksgiving, and so that people can be back home during Thanksgiving. In the springtime, of course, we do something similar with the five-day elder sesshin and just a few days later, regular seven-day sesshin. And this is an important point of practice here at Mountain Gate, that we try to go as deep as possible. We try to offer opportunities for people to do so as much as we can, given the American calendar and the fact that most people are not monks living in a monastery, but have to be out and about doing their regular work. And in America, of course, we don't really get much in the way of vacation time. It was extraordinary when a couple of friends of mine long ago in Rochester decided to start making tofu commercially. And so they set up shop, actually originally in a little off room of the basement of the Rochester Zen Center, and then they were able to rent a little bit of space in what had been an old manufacturing building. And now that tofu company, which has since been bought out by somebody else, I have no idea who, I haven't followed the train of things, is pretty much the tofu company for the East Coast of the United States. And when Andy and Greg decided to start a company, and they knew that they would most likely be hiring fellow Zen practitioners and to work in the company, they decided they were going to offer enlightened benefits, which meant in the beginning, before they had any money at all, they gave 6 weeks of vacation a year. And this was, and still is, astounding for the United States, where we are so imbued with a Puritan work ethic that we think we've got to have nose to the grindstone 24/7, no matter what. But to do two sesshin in a row is really a benefit. Life is short, as you've heard so many times. It makes a big difference. Everybody who has come here because there's some level of discomfort pervading their lives, and they want to be free of it. the human condition, because we are so conditioned, and because we grow up with misperceptions about ourselves, with odd ideas gained from assumptions about what other people think or do around us or to us. And so we are a prisoner of really our own thoughts, our own ideas, our own misperceptions. And yet we have this wonderful cutting-edge tool, the susapkan, coupled with the yearning, the need to know, the curiosity, the need to be free, truly free, as well as the koans, to cut away at this self-image, this idea, and to clarify our minds so that little by little by little by little we begin to see life more clearly. We begin to become more aware of our own reactions to our assumptions about things and people and circumstances. And that allows us the opportunity to drop that way of thinking, that way of being, that habit pattern. And as we continue this, we become more and more free. At the same time, we become more and more aware. So we may not feel we're becoming more and more free because we see more and more where we're caught. But that caughtness has always been there. It didn't just come when we started doing Zazen, and that's very important to realize. The Zazen has more or less turned the light on in the room of our mind to show us where we're caught. And in the process of doing that, if we persist, we will become free. We have a choice, of course, when we see where we're caught, when we see negative habit patterns that we're acting out on. And we have a choice to continue in that groove, because it is a groove, or to do the work of opting out. And it's only in doing the work of opting out that we gradually become free. There are way too many examples in America these days, and have been in America these days, of people who have, and I'm talking in the Zen world, and in particular Zen teachers, who have not done that important work. They may have had a Kensho experience, and they may be quite skilled at solving subsequent koans. But all too many have ignored that long maturation that Tore Enji emphasized in practice. And so this opening to the beginning to catch glimpses of when we are not being the kind of person we really assumed we were and of course want to be, then that offers us this tremendous opportunity to change the direction of that habit pattern that has us reacting in the way that creates negativity and discomfort and ultimately potentially some serious suffering. So I'd like to share again today with you a little bit more, bits and pieces here now, this one, of the teachings of Gusan Sunim, the 20th century Korean Son master, very, very highly regarded, and teacher to some of the principal Korean Son teachers in the United States and Europe. He has listed a number of points to theoretically spur us on in our practice. I'm not going to share all of them because not all of them really are relevant to us. many of them are more relevant to being a monk. There are 16 methods, he says, of carefully examining oneself while practicing meditation. Furthermore, he said, the ancients have said, if you do not save yourself during this lifetime, in what other lifetime will you have the opportunity to do so? Given that it is considered to be extremely rare to find a human life, there are so many creatures on this planet, a gazillion bugs, and birds and animals and fish and all kinds of creatures, and far more than there are human beings. And so the assumption is we have a much better chance of being reborn as a pig or a cow or a salmon than we do of being reborn as a human being. Being born as a human being is considered a very high birth and a very optimal birth because it gives us a chance to practice. And then along with the rarity of being born a human being is the rarity of encountering the Dharma. And then even more rare of finding a resonance with the Dharma to the point where we want to practice it. And finding a teacher with whom to practice, because that is essential if we're really going to come to awakening. It's extremely rare for a person to have a Kensho experience on their own. There are even contemporary tales of people who have done so. Ramana Maharshi in India, for example. Jacques Le Cerin in France, well, actually in Germany, at the time of his awakening experience. For another, Flora Courtois in the United States, another. But each of these people had deep motivation to find a truth beyond where they were living. In Ramana Maharshi's case, when he was 14 years old, he suddenly was gripped by a terror of death. And considering his family, his friends, he couldn't see any reason why he should be gripped by that fear. And he decided to walk bravely in it. And so he lay himself down on the floor in his room, his bedroom of his uncle's house where he was living, in order to be able to go to a particular school in a different town from where his family lived. And he pretended that he was dead. He imagined what it must be like not to be breathing anymore, body growing cold and stiff. He imagined his body being carried to the burning grounds and burnt. So that's what they did in those days and still do in those days in India and in many countries, really, of Asia. I remember being out for a drive when we were living in Chiang Mai, Thailand, and seeing a single file of people burying a bier, really. I mean, it was just a platform that was carried on the shoulders of a couple of men that had a body on it. And they were taking it out to be cremated. And also while we were in Thailand, one of the people working at the embassy died of hepatitis, and we went to his funeral and were part of the group that lit incense and put incense on the pyre, a symbolic way of lighting the fire. They actually just burnt the body. Piled high with, or it was sitting high on, or not sitting, lying high, on a pile of wood, more like brush, things that would burn relatively fast and hot. And the last thing that was done before the ritual lighting of the fire was the family bathed his face in coconut milk And then we went around with incense and dropped our incense sticks on the bier, and then somebody took actually a flame and lit it. Kusan Sunim, in another book, it tells of his own cremation in Korea. How much time do we have left? This is one of the things that Kusan Sunim emphasizes on these last remaining days of that 90-day retreat that he was leading, that this book is sharing with us the teachings that he gave during that retreat. And so one of these is, are you aware that with the passing of each thought, this impure body composed of the four elements is decaying? The body is composed of the four basic elements of earth, water, fire, and air. It is said to be impure because if you look inside it, you'll find it to be composed of such things as urine, feces, blood, gastric juices, and bones. It is as though these things have been assembled together and put into a bag made out of skin. The breath then passes in and out of this bag. This is what we call a human body. When such a body is healthy, you have the impression that you could live for 100 or 1,000 years. In fact, most of the time we don't even think about it until we get older or until somebody near us dies. However, are you not aware that with the passing of each thought, you're taking a step along the path that leads only to death? Every minute, every second, with every moment, time rushes on and propels you towards death. Do you realize that your life force depends upon each single breath? No matter who you are, your life force is contained within each breath you take. A single inhalation and exhalation is equivalent to 100 years. For if you exhale but are unable to inhale again, even a human life of 100 years will come to an end. In this lifetime, have you met the Buddhas and patriarchs? Were you born at the time of the Buddha, then you could have met him. However, if in this lifetime you meet a spiritual advisor who practices meditation well, then this can be said to be the equivalent to meeting one of the patriarchs. To encounter such beings is not the result of an insignificant karmic circumstance. On the contrary, it is due to karmic conditions that are only met with once every 100 million eons. When you hear discourse on the unsurpassable Dharma, do you appreciate how rare and precious this is? And then he tells of a tale that Hariroshi sometimes tells. In one of his previous lives, the Buddha was born as a king. One day, a yaksha, which is translated as a cannibal spirit who lives on blood, appeared before him and said, "Since all conditioned things are impermanent, they are subject to production and destruction." That's a quote out of the Vimalakirti Sutra, I think. Upon hearing these words of Dharma, the king was so delighted that he bowed down out of thanks to the yaksha and praised him for having expounded such a profound teaching. Since all conditioned things are impermanent, they are subject to production and destruction. Since our body is impermanent, it is subject to being produced and destroyed. In response, the yaksha said that there were other teachings that surpassed what he had already taught. However, he was very hungry at the moment and would have to drink some warm blood before he could deliver them. The king immediately offered him his own body for this purpose, and the yaksha accepted it. However, since the king could only listen to the teaching while he was still alive, he suggested that he would climb to the top of a tall tree and, once the discourse was over, would leap down and thus make a sacrifice of his body. The yaksha agreed to this suggestion, and the king then climbed to the top of a nearby tree. Then the yaksha then said, When production and destruction cease, nirvana is happiness. When we quit producing these ideas about ourselves, then there is happiness. In a nutshell, that's why we start practice. That's why we stick out practice. Because it can happen. When we quit manufacturing ideas about ourselves, when we let go of the ones we have, then we can truly be happy and at peace. But that's not why we practice. In the Mahayana Zen Buddhism, we practice for the benefit of all beings, not just for ourselves. When production and destruction cease, nirvana is happiness. When he heard these words, the king was so delighted that he immediately jumped down from the tree so that the yaksha could eat his body. But at this very moment, the yaksha was suddenly transformed in Indra, the king of the gods. He caught the king in his arms and praised him for disregarding his body for the sake of the Dharma. Likewise, we too should have such a strong resolution when listening to the true Dharma. In this way, we will proceed swiftly to the realization of Buddhahood. Do you engage in unnecessary conversation with those who sit next to you? The more you chatter, the more you will delusive thoughts continue to arise unimpeded. And this is why we ask for silence, except for exceptional circumstances during sesshin. Because even a couple of casual words will let loose the floodgates of thoughts and make it so much more difficult for a person's practice. And if somebody heard you speaking, then that's more than one person that's going to have difficulty in their practice. So it's important to turn inward, to pay enough attention outward that we can continue to live appropriately and work appropriately and follow the practice and follow the schedule and so on and so forth during sesshin. But be warned that if we indulge in even a single thought or a single word, this goes for thoughts as well, because it is so tempting to just one little nice thought about something, then again, we put ourselves at a huge disadvantage because it does let loose a torrent of further thoughts and words. And it's much harder to get the horses back in the corral after they've galloped out. The more you chatter, the more will delusive thoughts continue to arise unimpeded. Therefore, no progress will be made in your practice. Furthermore, you should not suggest to other meditators that they should go out and enjoy themselves, thus preventing them from meditating diligently. In the face of adverse and favorable conditions, do your perceptions of seeing, hearing, feeling, etc. form a single mass? You should avoid falling prey to the lure of external circumstances. Instead, try to keep your concentration of mind uniform and steady. All perceptions, whether of good or bad, of the universe or your own body, should maintain a uniform quality, thus uniting them in a single mass. In other words, focus on your practice and let everything else go. Giving enough attention that you can move with a group and take care of the necessary things that have to be taken care of during sesshin. But all the rest of your energy, your focus, your involvement, your concentration goes to the practice. That's what sesshins are for. Does your mind remain unmoved when subjected to the eight winds? There is a scroll in the dining hall at Hidden Valley Zen Center that reads, though the eight winds may blow, it is not disturbed. What is this it? This is what we are seeking to uncover. The eight winds, classically, are gain, loss, fame, disrepute, praise, criticism, pleasure, and displeasure. When you see pleasant or unpleasant things, or when you're confronted by adverse or favorable conditions, do you always remain collected and undisturbed? That does not mean being a zombie. It means being so present with whatever appears to be going on that there is a spaciousness within which you can respond clearly and wisely to those circumstances. Do you always remain collected and undisturbed and keep your mind as steady as a mountain and as tranquil as the deep ocean? And then I'm going to share a little bit of jump over one. The seventh lecture. Today is the beginning of the free season. You remember that in earlier Taisho I mentioned that the traditional way of practicing Zen in Korea is to go on these long concentrated retreats, 90-day retreats, for example, and then at the end of that time to possibly go elsewhere and either do your own private retreat at a different place or to practice with a different group temporarily and then perhaps come back again to this main temple to work on another extended practice period. It seems to be the way that things were done. Martine Batchelor has written a book about her own training, and she talks about essentially she lived at Songkhwan San, and during the off periods went around to various different places and still practiced. The practice at the time, it was a different way of practicing. It's like during Sesshin, we have our formal periods of practice, and then we have Yaza, where it's less formal. It's not formal at all. We can go sit out on the deck. We can sit anywhere in the sendo. We can sit as long or as short as we want. There are no bells, no clappers, no markers of time. And we can just dive quietly and deeply into our practice. And it's that balance in practice. And here, because we are such, as so many of us are lay people, we unwittingly have the same kind of practice in our daily lives, because we come here for Sesshin, and we go out and try to keep our practice together and do our regular daily practice and our practice in the midst of activity as we're doing our work out and about in the world with all the various distractions and interactions and complications that occur there. It's a nice balance. Many years ago, let's start there. Many years ago, Kapla Roshi would come out to Santa Fe a couple of times a year, and we would rent Bodhi, which in those days was called Bodhi Mandala. That's a Rinzai monastery run by monks who were students of Sasaki Joshu. And we would rent that place, and Roshi would do a sesshin there. And it was impossible to do a Rochester-style sesshin there. We did the best we could, but the environment just wouldn't allow us to do it exactly the way it had been done in Rochester. And Rochester, every sesshin, it was the same. There are no mirrors in the place, so you can't see what you look like, so you're not reminded or distracted by, oh my God, look at those bags under my eyes. Oh my God, another pimple. Oh no, I'm going to die. And so on and so forth. Because as soon as we look in a mirror, there's a chance for, and most likely what that will happen, an inner dialogue about what we're seeing. And eyes are down, it's absolutely silent. We face the wall, so there is very, very little distraction in our practice. And it's done that way on purpose, so that there will be little distraction, so that we will be able to practice in one version of an optimal training environment. And then at Bodhi, it's basically impossible to do that. For one thing, in the summertime, time of year when Kapla Roshi would come out, it was the rainy season, and Bodhi is in a narrow canyon in the mountains, in the Jemez Mountains in northern New Mexico, and every afternoon, like clockwork, the storms would race through the canyon toward the north, and it really is a true monsoon in New Mexico, and with that comes monsoon level rains, not so much in amount of rain, but certainly in the force of rain. I remember when I was living in Rangoon, being amazed at watching raindrops bounce down so hard that they bounced up 3 feet in the air after hitting the ground. The rain came down with that much force. And here in New Mexico, it's pretty forceful too. And so this amazing rain driven almost horizontal, coming racing right at us when we had no choice but to have the Dokusan waiting line outdoors on a deck. It basically obliterated Dokusan. It certainly made it take much different form than it normally did in Rochester. And then, of course, it was also the June bugs in the bed, the June bugs everywhere. And then there were hot springs. And every other night, the men had days 1, 3, 5, 7, and the women had days 2, 4, and 6 in the hot springs. And periodically, people would crash the hot springs from, they would just come up the river that ran behind the monastery and join in. I remember being in the hot springs at one point when a couple of guys crashed it. And here we are, 7 or 8 naked Rochester Zen Center students sitting in the pool in the dark, or at least in the dusk. And these guys were trying to make conversation, and of course, we were not making conversation. We were trying to be in Sesshin. And happily, they gave up rather quickly and left. But then there was the period, the work period, when the Bodhi women who stayed in residence while we were having our Sesshins there decided they would come down during the work period and take their soak in the hot springs. And so they came down the path and stripped naked at the hot springs and climbed in. And at the time, there was a Rochester Zen Center work party weeding around the hot springs. And you can imagine the challenge the guys were having at keeping their practice in tow in the midst of a bunch of naked women. But the interesting thing about this is that suddenly a lot of people start having Kensho experiences. Why? Because they weren't able to keep same old practice going. They had to work harder. They had to work differently. And that brought them deep enough to have a Kensho experience. So this is possibly behind the system in Korean Son to do concentrated periods of of sesshin. Can you imagine doing sesshin for 90 days straight? And then to have a different way of working, but still keeping that practice going. You heard in earlier teshos this week about Kusan Sunim's own travels, one of which at least a friend of his that he was traveling with, there were three of them, and one of them got very, very ill and died while traveling. Died, not yet having had Kensho experience. Kusan Sunim was so moved by this that he promised his friend before his friend died that he would have a Kensho experience so that his friend could also pass over. So today is the beginning of the free season. Free season actually implies the realization of your own true nature and the continuation of the wisdom of the Buddhas and the patriarchs. Furthermore, it only becomes genuine release from restriction, and technically the translation is release from restriction, when you are able to compassionately guide and help other beings. If there is anyone here who has reached such a state, then say something. And the assembly remained silent. So he continues, since no one says anything, now it cannot really be the free season. So what excuse do you have for idly enjoying yourselves, relaxing, and thus wasting your time? And then he quotes a poem. Having been unable to enter the mysterious gateway of the patriarchs, but nevertheless being proud, is like trying to cross the ocean on the back of a mosquito. Surely this would be self-deception. To presumptuously claim to have seen one's true nature would be like saying that one has bound Mount Chogye with spider webs. Those who noisily proclaim to be awakened only succeed in deceiving themselves and cheating the sages, and happily we don't have anybody here under those circumstances. Such lies are as futile as trying to bind Mount Chogye with spider webs. And those who, without having been able to awaken, just enjoy themselves and wander here and there are like people trying to cross the ocean by riding mosquitoes. Do you think that anyone could ever succeed in either binding Mount Chogye with spider webs or crossing the ocean on a mosquito? By deceiving yourself in such a way, how could your life not be in vain and your death full of distress? Therefore, you should never pretend to have awakened when, in fact, you have not. And again, I don't think we have anybody here that fills that category of pretending. Your sole task is to search for the subtle nirvanic mind of all Buddhas in the midst of the mind of yourself, a sentient being. This means that by cultivating the mind you have as a sentient being, you will finally discover the subtle nirvanic mind of all Buddhas. You should not search for it elsewhere. Birth and death are indeed a great matter. But life is highly unstable and transient. For being unable to inhale one single breath will mark the end of a human life that may have endured for 100 years. Since the continuity of life depends upon each single breath, how can you ever know when you will die? If death only afflicted the old and not the young, then, being assured of many years ahead, you could have, with justification, lie down and just sleep comfortably. But this is not the case. Birth and death are a great matter. Life passes swiftly by. So how can you permit yourself to behave in a wild and uncontrolled manner? When the light of your eyes falls to the ground at death, regrets will be completely in vain. At that time, conscious at last that you will soon die, you may start worrying about what to do. But then, whatever you may try and do will be of no use. Throughout beginningless eons, the way has been obscured by the great weight and depth of defilements. Exactly how heavy and deep are these defilements? They are as heavy as the earth and as deep as the ocean. Defilements are actually the habitual tendencies you have acquired since beginning this time. Since they are so deeply ingrained within you and weigh you down so greatly, how can you not see the need to practice with the utmost diligence? The defilements are like clouds covering the sun. Although the sun shines brightly behind the clouds, its brightness cannot be seen. Only when the clouds disperse will its brilliance be clearly apparent. And this, of course, is the classic metaphor for the human mind. We have all of these ideas about ourselves, these assumptions, these conditioned reflexes, these habit patterns. They're like the clouds hiding the brilliant, clear sky of our awareness, of our true mind. And we take the clouds to be real. They certainly feel real, don't they? But as soon as we become aware of them, already they are thinned out. Take advantage of that. Now, if you really want to unearth a precious gem from the mud and stones of defilements, you should think of how snow and ice harden and melt. Recently, there's been much snow here. Now it's packed and hardened on the ground and will not melt very quickly. Just look. The snow is delivering an unsurpassable discourse on Dharma. For to dissolve the defilements and discover your true nature is similar to the melting of the snow. In order for it to melt, it must be exposed to the sun. And thankfully, we have a lot of sun out here in New Mexico, and the snow out there all about is melting. How about the snow of the defilements of your own mind? It certainly has melted some through these 6.5, 6.75 days. Can you take it a step further? And when you go home after Sesshin, what then? Can you bring with you firm resolve to make practice a priority? There are so many things we're drawn to do out and about in our life. But life is short. How much time do we have? Do this important work. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. Thank you for listening.